Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Food poisoning affects roughly 1 in 6 people in the U.S. every year. Salmonella is the most common known cause of hospitalization due to food poisoning. It kills more people in the U.S. than any other foodborne pathogen. Every year, there are 1.35 million illnesses, 26,500 hospitalizations, and more than 400 deaths. Salmonella also inflicts a huge economic cost, an estimated $4 billion. Every year, more than any other type of food poisoning. An eight-month ProPublica investigation into a once rare but now pervasive strain of salmonella reveals how the failure of the U.S. food system, including the USDA and the Department of Agriculture, along with the powerful chicken lobby, has failed to protect the U.S. public. The report is called America's Food Safety System failed to stop a salmonella epidemic. It's still making people sick. With a public health threat unfolding across the country, we might have expected regulators to act swiftly and decisively to warn the public, recall the contaminated poultry, and compel changes at chicken plants. But none of that happened. The treatment-resistant strain has made thousands sick and killed 2 people, and yet infected meat is still being sold. So why has the U.S. government failed to hold the chicken industry accountable and educate the public about the dangers of this salmonella strain? Today, we are joined by 2 of the reporters who worked on this important and undercovered story. Bernice Yearng is an award-winning reporter for ProPublica. In 2020, Bernice was a member of a team of journalists who covered the impact of COVID on meatpacking workers, which was honored with a Polk Award. Bernice Yearng was just named managing editor of the investigative reporting program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Hi, Bernice. Thank you so much for this important piece and huge congratulations on just being named managing editor at the UC Berkeley J School.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you back. We're also joined by Irina Wong, a data reporter with ProPublica. Hi, Irina. Thank you so much for your great work at ProPublica and bringing this story to light.
So glad to be here.
Great to have you. So first off, this is such an important piece. You and your colleagues worked 8 months on this investigation. How did you come to focus on this particular strain of salmonella? Bernice, why don't you start off?
Sure. So I think we were first driven by this really interesting statistic. My reporting partner, one of our reporting partners, Michael Graybell, had come across this statistic that said that essentially while salmonella foodborne poisoning rates had continued to grow in the United States, we had seen significant drops in other types of foodborne illness, such as foodborne illness involving E. coli. So really the question became initially, why? And it led us down this long reporting path where it took us to salmonella and the fact that salmonella is essentially the largest, most important foodborne illness in terms of its most frequent, but also it's not very well regulated in the United States, especially when it comes to meat and poultry. There's essentially no way in which the USDA can currently pull tainted meat that has salmonella from store or restaurants. And we really wanted to understand how this whole regulatory structure came to be. In the process of doing that, we looked at an outbreak that happened in 2018, 2019. And what really jumped out at us was that this was a strain of salmonella that was multi-drug resistant. So that meant that the most common types of antibiotics used to treat the most severe types of salmonella would not be effective against this strain of salmonella. Meanwhile, USDA and federal regulators were finding this type of salmonella in meat at the processing plants. They were aware that it was there. Regulators were also finding it in grocery stores when they were doing random sampling. So it seemed to us that there was this particular strain of salmonella that seemed particularly risky, and yet there was no real food safety regulation or action being taken around it. And we really wanted to understand why that was.
I'm sure that listeners' eyebrows went up when you said that the USDA has no authority to control salmonella on farms where the bacteria often spreads. And you report that even when there's persistent evidence of contamination in a plant's products, the USDA cannot use those findings to suspend operations. All they can do is conduct a general review of the plant. Irina, can you tell us why this is the case?
That's a great question. Actually, I might throw that back to Bernice, if that's okay.
Sure.
Irina did some really amazing work on the genetic sequencing and analysis of this particular strain of salmonella to show essentially that this strain of salmonella, even though the CDC declared this outbreak over, it continues to circulate within the chicken industry. And I think what was really striking to us at the outset of the reporting is that salmonella is perfectly legal to have on your meat and poultry when you go to the grocery store and you buy it, or when a restaurant receives it from their purveyor. There's essentially no regulation related to salmonella on the final product. It's perfectly legal to sell. And that really raised our eyebrows as reporters initially. And again, to understand why, you kind of have to take this kind of long jog back into history a bit. But there was initially when our food safety laws were drafted, this was 1906 when it comes to meat and poultry. This is kind of the Upton Sinclair era where he had exposed the terrible practices at meatpacking plants. But really at that time, the concern was primarily around disease and spoilage. And rotten meat getting to consumers. And so that was the real focus of what the USDA did at that time at slaughterhouses, the kind of quote unquote poke and sniff, you know, the carcasses as they're going by on the assembly line. As time has passed, of course, we now understand that foodborne pathogens, bacteria can make people sick. And we didn't really have the infrastructure in terms of the regulations to really, tackle that. And it really wasn't until 1993, 1994, with the terrible Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak in hamburgers, that the federal government took a step back and said, we really do have to address foodborne pathogens in raw meat. And so that's what's triggered some beginning of efforts to address bacteria on raw meat and poultry. But when it comes to salmonella itself, it is still not declared what's known as a quote-unquote adulterant or something that would be illegal to be sold, you know, on raw meat and poultry. And a part of the reason for that is that there's a really interesting series of court cases, essentially, some dating back to the 1970s, that say that the USDA doesn't have regulatory authority, or that have been interpreted by the USDA, I should say, to say that they don't have regulatory authority over salmonella. And then in the late 1990s, when the USDA tried to assert some authority over salmonella and tried to regulate around salmonella, you know, the courts held that they, again, did not have the authority to close down meat processing facilities if salmonella is found on their product.
Let's talk about some of the data that you uncovered. Irina, you wrote a piece called How ProPublica Used Genomic Sequencing Data to Track an Ongoing Salmonella Outbreak. And you write that your reporting relied on public records requests and dozens of interviews, the bread and butter of journalism, but I also made use of a type of data ProPublica has never before tapped into, publicly available genomic sequencing data. So can you tell us more about how you got access to this data?
Sure. So like I mentioned in the piece, the data was actually publicly available. It still is. It's released through the National Center for Biotechnology Information, NCBIs, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, has something called the Pathogen Detection Project. And this project aggregates a bunch of genomic sequencing data about all these different sorts of pathogens that are being found in food inspections, that are being taken from patients in hospitals who are showing up in hospitals with food poisoning, And all this information is aggregated in this database that actually anyone can go on and check out if they wanted. You know, you can head over to ncbi.nlm.nih.gov and just go in and browse all of this information about different bacterial samples that the government is keeping an eye on.
And so how did you parse out this data?
Yeah, absolutely. This is where things got really interesting for me, because I think as a journalist, I'm so used to working with public databases where information is sometimes missing, especially when it comes to personal information. And I was also, on the other hand, very used to working with the sort of genomic sequencing data because of my PhD work. Before becoming a data journalist, I did a PhD in electrical engineering, but focused on bioinformatics. And so it was really interesting to bring these two worlds together, especially through these public records requests, which really helped us match up information about the Salmonella outbreak in 2018 that we were investigating with this data that's publicly available. And by cross-referencing these two sets of data, we were able to better understand exactly what information agencies like the CDC and the USDA had on hand and how they use that information to make their decisions.
And can you just give us a sense of the scope of all of this? Because when you think about life a couple of generations ago, you still had family farms, right? And that's just no longer the case. I mean, some of these slaughterhouses are processing 75,000 chickens a day in just one plant. I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around the numbers of chickens and turkeys that are raised for food and then slaughtered for food. So can you just talk about just the amount of data that is now available and how difficult or is it difficult to really go through it, given that we're talking about so many animals here?
Absolutely. So let's see. For this piece in particular, I think I wrote in my piece that I ended up doing some sort of calculation where I needed to look at, you know, up to 32 million pairs of samples, bacterial samples. And so the scope of this means that, or the scope of this sort of alludes to the fact that we're dealing with a lot of information. I think that if I recall correctly, USDA Food Safety and Inspection Services are continually conducting tests at meat processing facilities. And furthermore, during the outbreak, there are hundreds of cases pulled. There are hundreds of patients that both arrived at the hospital, but also there are cases from these inspections that were linked to this outbreak. And so in total, we were looking at thousands of different samples, different bacterial isolate samples. But if, you know, this is only actually a drop in all of the data that's available about bacteria that the government's keeping an eye on. I think if you log on to the pathogen detection browser right now, I think they've got close to a million different samples. So from a data perspective, it's kind of very fun. It's like, you know, the more data, the better.
Right. What would you add to that, Bernice? Just the amount of data that is available based on the situation we're in right now with, you know, 75,000 chickens being slaughtered in one day at one plant.
I think what's really interesting, despite this, you know, what Irina was saying, I mean, there is a tremendous volume of data being collected. But in terms of what the USDA itself is collecting, you know, it's a tiny fragment of the whole picture. I think it's something like 8 samples a day are collected, you know, from plants across the country, because their testing regime is such that it's one sample per week, you know, in various facilities. And so it's just a tiny number of the actual product that's going out.
Can you repeat that again, Bernice? And I only ask you because I was just looking up, you know, how many chickens, for example, are slaughtered every day or every week. And according to Sentient Media, Tyson Foods alone slaughters 37, okay, I've got to read this right, 37 million chickens a week through 50 facilities, which means the total daily number of birds killed every day is 5.3 million.
So we have this number here that you know, 80 samples of raw poultry across hundreds of processing plants are collected, on an average day in the U.S. And these are plants that slaughter 25 million chickens and turkeys a day. So it is a very small number. So in terms of the whole picture of what salmonella looks like, in terms of the rates of salmonella, this is, again, a very small slice of the whole picture.
And when you talk to people about what needs to change, given that this is all so massive, what do they tell you?
They tell us that we really need to focus in on the types of salmonella that make people sick. We need to look at the amount of salmonella that's on a product. The big concern and quibble that various parties have with the current salmonella system with raw meat and poultry is that it's this kind of very crude yes, no, up or down testing system. So it's, do you have salmonella or don't you on this one particular sample that we've, taken out of production this one day this week? And a lot of people within the industry, government scientists, are saying, well, actually, our science is better now. We know that if we can figure out the quantity of salmonella on a raw sample, that's much more useful information for us in terms of how it affects public health. Simultaneously, we know that there are 2,500 different types of salmonella out there in the world, more than that. But only a handful of those, a fraction of that, actually makes people sick or is known to make people sick. So shouldn't we focus on those particular types of salmonella that make people sick and really focus our testing and attention on those particular types? Those are some of the things that are being discussed, at the USDA level through this kind of new rethinking that you mentioned at the top of the program.
Today, we are speaking with two reporters who worked on this 8-month ProPublica investigation, and I hope you can take the time to read it. It's called America's Food Safety System Failed to Stop a Salmonella Epidemic. It is still making people sick. We're joined today by Bernice Jung, an award-winning reporter for ProPublica, and Irina Wong, a data reporter for ProPublica. If you have any questions for Bernice or Irina, we'd love to hear from you. If you regularly eat chicken or turkey, is this something that you've thought about? If you or someone you know has ever had food poisoning or salmonella, can you give us a call? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And just really generally questions about the safety of the U.S. food system. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Irina, I'm sure a lot of people are just wondering, what can I do to keep my family safe? And you all put together an incredible online tool. The USDA sampling allowed you to create a tool that people can use to check the salmonella records of the plants that process their chicken and their turkey. Can you tell us more about this tool?
Sure. So the USDA regularly releases information about their test results from these meat processing facilities. Our colleagues, Andrea Suato, Ash Nu, and other folks on the news applications team took that data and organized it and created a news application, an online a website where any consumer can check the package of chicken that they've bought, type in something called a P number, and find out the testing results of that meat processing facility. It's a really handy tool. Honestly, I use it as a consumer myself because it helps me better understand, this chicken that I'm buying, it was processed at this plant. Now, how frequently was salmonella found at this plant? Not only how frequently was salmonella found, period, what type of salmonella was found? And the tool is really handy in that it breaks results down as Bernice mentioned, science is showing that not all salmonella is the same. This is based on genetics. This is based on what we know about salmonella. And so the tool does this thing where it shows you in a little sort of cartoon of a calendar, in the past year, out of all of the samples that were taken from this plant, how many of them had salmonella? How many of the salmonella were considered high risk by the USDA? And did this plant meet the USDA standard or did they fail it? So I highly encourage consumers who are concerned about their chicken to, even while you're at the grocery store, just pull up this website and check your chicken.
Bernice, do you know if organic chicken is any different? Has salmonella been found on organic chicken?
You know, this is a topic that has brought great consternation to some of my friends and colleagues who have, you know, put their organic chicken brand into the chicken checker only to discover that it is sometimes no better or worse than the non-organic brands. And that's certainly true for the type of chicken that I buy at my local store. It's a, you know, organic free-range brand that is very popular in the Bay Area. Restaurants advertise that they buy this particular brand and serve it. And when you put in that particular brand, you know, it depends on which farm and it depends on which type of product, whether it's a whole, you know, chicken or parts or ground, but there is essentially no difference if it's organic versus non-organic. I'm sorry to report.
Yeah, we're getting actually quite a few emails about this. Anita writes, I generally buy my chicken at Trader Joe's and I buy the organic. Am I just kidding myself and thinking that this is a better choice?
I think it's, you know, depends on how you're weighing your consumer choices. There's obviously other benefits to organic. But when it comes to salmonella, we haven't seen a difference. I have to say this is anecdotal, but from the organic brands that we've entered in versus the non-organic brands, we haven't seen a difference. Same with kosher chicken. That has been another question that's circulated. And we haven't seen a difference between kosher and non-kosher either.
What response have you received from this tool, Irina, given that it is just so easy to use and so, so important?
I think the last we checked, we had over 500 responses from consumers. Oh, I should back up a bit. Sorry. Generally, the response we've gotten is like, wow, we're glad this information is out there. And another component to the tool is not only are we showing consumers information that we have or that the USDA is putting out about these meat processing facilities, but we've also got a form at the bottom of the page where once you find some chicken that, you know, where the results were interesting to you in any way, we are hoping that consumers can help us further report on the poultry supply chain by submitting the results of this chicken. And so the sort of piece that is missing in the story, in the supply chain story right now is we know that contamination is happening at farms. We know that contamination is happening at food processing facilities. But the question now is, where is this chicken being distributed? And that is what we're hoping to get information from consumers from. And happily, we've gotten, you know, a lot of responses. But as a data nerd, I can say, again, the more data, the better. So we're hoping that the reaction remains positive.
It was also interesting to check out the poultry plants by state section of your website. Roughly 600 plants process most of the chicken and turkey sold in the United States. California has the most, 75. And what's incredible about your database is you name them all. I mean, this is the thing. We talk about chicken, turkey, beef, but there's no name connected to it usually. And a lot of people know about Foster Farms and Tyson. But here in this incredible database you all put together, Pittman Farms in Sanger, California, ground chicken, chicken parts, whole chicken, whole turkey, a TNJ sausage kitchen in Anaheim, Heatherfield Foods in Ontario, ground chicken, D brand poultry in La Puente, California, chicken parts. I mean, I can just go on and on. I'm sure that most people have never heard of any of these brands. Rose Meat Services, never heard of that one, chicken parts. Bernice, what about that? It's so interesting that there are so many out there, and yet most people have only heard of some of the top brands.
That's absolutely true. I think that was, again, one of these kind of epiphany moments that we had during the reporting when a source told us, hey, did you know, by the way, there's this thing called a P number on most packages of chicken. It's usually located near the, you know, the USDA mark of inspection, you know, that so-called stamp of approval that the USDA gives. And so sure enough, we went to the local grocery stores and there was the P number. And what the USDA has done is they have, because they're doing all this sampling now of salmonella and E. coli and a couple other bacteria, they're putting them all into spreadsheets by the plant names, by dates, and they're putting them online that you can then download. But it's a complete hassle to try to, you know, download these Excel spreadsheets and then sort them and read them and try to make sense of them. So that's where we thought, you know, making this app, making this tool so that it's actually readily accessible to consumers would be a helpful thing, especially since the USDA purportedly created these spreadsheets and made the sampling data public so that consumers could make more informed choices around, you know, the raw meat and poultry that they're buying. But yes, it is startling how many different processors there are out there. Within that list is not only those big, you know, Tyson's and Purdue's and so on, but also some of the smaller ones and also those that are processing raw meat into things like sausages and other types of foods. So that also adds to the number, the sheer number of meat and poultry processors out there.
Right. Well, this is excellent information and so important. You can find the database on our website where you can type in the number that you find on the packaging if you eat chicken or turkey. You can find it. It's really easy. And then you can also read about all of the plants around the country. Today, we are talking about an important investigation from ProPublica, an 8-month investigation. And you can find it at yourcallradio.org. America's food safety system failed to stop a salmonella epidemic. It is still making people sick. Today, we're joined by Bernice Yearn, an award-winning reporter for ProPublica, and Irina Wong, a data reporter for ProPublica. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about an 8-month ProPublica investigation. America's food safety system failed to stop a salmonella epidemic. It is still making people sick. Bernice Yearn is an award-winning reporter for ProPublica who was just named managing editor at the investigative reporting program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Irina Wong is a data reporter with ProPublica. If you have any questions or comments for today's guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thanks for holding.
Hello. Thank you. Just two questions. One was I was calling to ask because I eat chicken, and I buy organic if I can. And what I do, though, is before I eat it, I freeze it. And it may be frozen for several days, maybe up to a week, and then I'll cook it. And that's the second part of the question, whether or not, one, freezing makes any difference with regard to the salmonella, and two, whether or not cooking it in a particular way, I have my own version of how I cook the chicken, can make any difference in this situation. So I'd love to hear their responses.
Okay, thank you. Bernice, do you know?
My understanding is that freezing it will certainly help the growth of the salmonella bacteria if it's present in that chicken. But it won't kill it. What will kill it is cooking it to 165 degrees throughout. So making sure that meat thermometer, when you stick it in, goes all the way down to the center and the whole thing is cooked through. But I think what the other thing that has been really interesting in doing this reporting is learning about how undercooking chicken is certainly a concern and a way that people get salmonella foodborne poisoning, but it's not the only way. The other common way in which salmonella spreads and makes people sick is through cross-contamination in your kitchen. So being really mindful of, you know, if you're handling your chicken, washing your hands afterwards, you know, when you're picking up your spice jars or you're opening the refrigerator, you know, using your phone to look up your recipe, making sure that all of those are not getting cross-contaminated with any kind of raw chicken that you've handled. I think another really, really big misconception, misunderstanding is that you should wash your chicken. And I know this might spark a lot of debate and generate even more calls, but the USDA advises that you do not wash your chicken, because that's just a way for you. If, again, if there is salmonella present on that raw chicken, it'll just circulate and spread that salmonella all over your kitchen, all over your sink. I know a lot of people like to wash their chicken because they're concerned about the various chemicals and such that are used, again, to try to reduce salmonella, ironically. But does not help you to wash the chicken. It's just best to cook it thoroughly and be careful how you handle it.
And Bernice, do people use thermometers? I mean, you mentioned making sure that it's, what, 165 degrees?
That is one of the disturbing discoveries that the USDA and the FDA have learned over the years in doing their consumer education research and trying to really work with consumers to properly handle their chicken. Only a tiny fraction of people actually use meat thermometers. The big joke around ProPublica and the office now is that we're going to get everybody meat thermometers for the holidays. Because it's just not something that people have handy, and people tend to do a lot of, you know, guesswork, touching, but not enough people use meat thermometers.
Right. I was wondering about that when you mentioned that. Well, thank you for the call, Greg. Let's go next to David in Berkeley. Hi, David.
Hi. Yeah, I want to thank for putting out this tool, because I, as an automotive being in the automotive field, I've noticed that agencies and the government make it really difficult to digest any of the information that they try to compile, and looking forward to using the tool. I'm calling specifically about air-chilled chickens, and interesting you mentioned about also washing chickens, because that was a big row between the U.S. and Great Britain, is that the FDA allows bleach to be used on commercial chickens to mitigate disease before they export them. But anyway, with the subject specific about air-chilled,
You just tell us, what is air-chilled chicken?
Well, as they slaughter them, and you know, they go on these huge racks like a dry cleaner hanging clothes. And they immediately are transferred into a deep freeze state. But the air is chilled to that freeze. They don't actually freeze the meat. And it particularly seems to apply early on the marketing of this product in smaller companies that deal with organic chickens. And we don't eat a lot of meat, maybe only 30% of our diet.
So are you wondering if salmonella has been found on these air-chilled chickens?
Well, I'm worried about now that I'm noticing it's starting to pop up into larger chain stores. Hmm. And I'm curious if those safeguards are going to be let down. Because, you know, people who don't eat a lot of meat, you know, if you've been attacked by some kind of salmonella, you know, the GI problems. And so, consequently, I haven't had those problems when we do eat air-chilled chickens. And I've noticed the prices plummeted on the processing when they got to the larger marketing people. I don't mm-hmm. want to mention
okay. name. So I think I get the gist of your question. So do you know, Bernice, is there any major changes between the smaller farms and then the massive chicken companies like Tyson and Purdue, for example?
In terms of how they handle and process,
yeah, let's say the whole process from the chicken to the whatever you found in your reporting, from raising the chicken to the outcome.
Well, I can tell you that we spoke to this very small chicken producer out of Texas. She you know, raises probably hundreds of chickens, maybe bordering towards 1,000 in a year, which is tiny compared to what a, you know, major purveyor like a Tyson might do. And she, you know, raises these chickens for small restaurants and for farmers markets and things of that sort in her area. And she also uses, she uses parasitic acid instead of bleach and, you know, for minimizing salmonella on her chickens. She does a lot around kind of the water flow when the chickens are placed into what's called a chiller to try to cool down the chickens, but also rinse them off. She also does the air chilling. And I think that at the end of the day, it's quite variable. There are large purveyors who do a great job, and there are large purveyors who do less great job. Same with the small purveyors. I think it speaks to ultimately, I think, those of us who are interested and who can, being able to learn about their particular processor and producer, having that, you know, ideally that type of relationship. It's very hard these days, and that's kind of why it's why we're very interested in having people go to the Chicken Checker and provide us with information about supply chain, because that's part of how we can demystify who, where your chicken is coming from. You can learn about who, you know, what those practices are. But it's quite variable in terms of how the chickens are raised and how they're processed. There's no on the farm level, there's no requirements in terms of how the chickens are raised from a food safety standpoint. Part of what we explored in our story was all the various points in raising chickens where salmonella can be introduced into the bird. And we know the various places where we could minimize the amount of salmonella. But there's no way for regulators at the moment to impose or require changes or interventions so that salmonella is minimized before they even get to the slaughterhouse.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for the question. Today, we are talking about an 8-month ProPublica investigation. America's food safety system failed to stop a salmonella epidemic. It is still making people sick. Bernice Jung is an award-winning reporter for ProPublica, and Irina Wong is a data reporter with ProPublica. Irina, we have an email from Michelle who says, is there any data regarding salmonella poisoning of the workers at processing plants?
That's a really good question. So I can't say that we have been looking at that data in particular, but in the course of reporting on the story, I have come across a few research articles that are looking into sort of cross-contamination between poultry plant workers and salmonella in chickens. And, you know, it's not zero. And actually, now that I think about it, Bernice might have more to say on this, but yeah, from the data that we're looking at, the data that we're looking at regarding these processing plants doesn't have information about the workers' conditions and their health. But that's certainly something that I've been thinking about and might be on our horizon.
Bernice, anything to add?
I was also just really fascinated by the fact that in this outbreak that we were looking at from 2019. That one of the people who got sick was the child of a poultry worker. And so we do know that it is, because of that cross-contamination we were talking about earlier, where when it's on the raw product and you can cross-contaminate in your kitchen, there seems to be some kind of, transference that can happen, to the poultry worker themselves. And we have read stories about people working in processing plants getting salmonella from handling the poultry at the plant itself. So there does seem to be a vehicle there. I don't know how frequently it happens.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. Irina, can you talk to us more about how this happens? We're just getting a lot of generic questions about how this actually happens. And you all have this interactive graphic on your website, or on your story, I should say, that says, when chickens are raised in crowded conditions, bacteria can proliferate through close contact, contaminated feed and communal water, pests or farm workers' boots as they move between the flocks. Salmonella can also develop in poultry litter, the organic material like sawdust that is spread on chicken house floors. As time passes, it becomes increasingly soaked in excrement, serving as a reservoir of salmonella contamination, according to the USDA. Irina, can you tell us a little bit more about how this actually happens?
Yeah, so like Bernice mentioned earlier, it's an issue of, so back to, you know, salmonella is a bacteria, and like any living organism, the bacteria's prerogative is to survive and to breed. And it seems, based on the reporting, what we found is that the conditions of chicken processing and chicken farming are, at this point, they appear to be conducive to allowing salmonella to proliferate through the poultry supply chain. Like you mentioned in our article, there's a pretty comprehensive graphic that walks readers through, you know, starting from chickens being raised in crowded conditions in farms where their excrement is being picked up by other birds and through close contact. And then as they move on to the processing facilities, the entire processing process, I suppose, there are all of these steps where, you know, in theory, there are these steps to mitigate the amount of salmonella that can be transferred between one contaminated chicken and another. There are these things like dunking tanks of scalding water. There are these rubber gloves that are supposed to remove feathers. Well, they do remove feathers, but there's the downside, which is they dislodge feces and sometimes massage dirty water into open follicles. The point is that it's a complex system, and the thing is, bacteria are these living organisms that are trying to survive, and bacteria and any organism tend to replicate, and as they replicate, they will acquire these mutations. And mutations that increase the probability of a bacteria surviving means that, unfortunately, sometimes bacteria that survive are particularly difficult to deal with.
It was also interesting to learn in the section about salmonella developing in poultry litter, the organic material like sawdust that is spread on chicken house floors. As time passes, it becomes soaked in chicken poop, basically. And Bernice, it was interesting to learn that in some countries like Sweden and Mexico, the bedding is changed after every flock or about 5 to 7 weeks. But in the United States, the litter is treated and turned over, but often changed only once a year. So Sweden and Mexico, it's changed every 5 to 7 weeks. And in the U.S., it's once a year.
That's right. That was also a shocker for me personally doing this reporting. I spoke to a chicken farmer, and he said that part of the issue is that, well, first of all, there, as many people know, a lot of chicken farmers are now under contract with some of the major poultry processors out there. So they're told exactly how to raise the chickens from the second that the chicks arrive at their farm. And so they're given instructions on things like feed and water and pest management, but also how to deal with their litter. So the litter, you know, they're given the instructions. You change it this often, and often it's once a year. So what they'll do is, after the first flock goes through, they'll do what's called windrowing. They'll pull them into these almost like these big piles, long piles, and let they'll try to let the bacteria cook out of the litter for a period of time, and then they'll just spread it back out again onto the chicken house floor, and then bring in the next flock. So that's kind of the standard for many chicken growers across the U.S. The real hitch for the chicken company and for the farmer is, what do you do with this litter once you're done with it. And that's part of the reason that we tend to turn it around and change it only once a year, because it's expensive to dispose of it. The farmer I was speaking with said that, he has to get trucks, he has to hire, trucks, they have to load it in, can cost, tens of thousands of dollars. And you can imagine, spending that much on each farm every, 5 to 7 weeks is just kind of a non-starter for many chicken companies out there.
We should also say, and this, we need, another hour to really go over more of this, but it's so, so important. You do not need to eat chicken to be affected by this, because you've got this devastating story of Marva Lamping and her longtime partner, Arthur Sutton. They decided to go out to celebrate his 70th birthday at their favorite Mexican restaurant, and they had chips and salsa while waiting for a platter of chicken enchiladas. And sadly, Arthur became very sick and passed away. And you report that an inspection of the restaurant found concerns with cross-contamination, because the restaurant thawed and washed frozen chicken in the same three compartment sinks in which it washed lettuce, tomatoes, and cilantro. So you don't have to be eating the chicken to be affected by this, right, Bernice?
That's right. I mean, again, it gets back to that cross-contamination issue of just making sure that, we have to treat the chicken as it has, germs on it that can proliferate and that can spread and that can be transferred to other surfaces. The other very devastating, narrative that we discovered in the process of doing this reporting is that there were a number of children, some of them infants, who got sick with this particular salmonella strain. And you think to yourself, well, how is that even possible? They're not eating chicken. But it's because that, well, the theory is that their baby bottles got cross-contaminated in the sink after the parents handled chicken, or that a toddler touched a package of raw chicken at the grocery store and then put her hand in her mouth. Mm-hmm. So there, I think we have to think about salmonella as being a germ in the same way that we think of, we're very germ conscious these days. And I think that's a good approach and a good mindset to adopt when you're thinking about how to prevent salmonella.
Right. And Irina, we're getting a lot of questions from people who say, how can I protect my family from all of this? Any other recommendations? We talked about, in case you're tuning in and you didn't hear this, they do have this incredible tool called the Chicken Checker. You can see how often salmonella was found at the plant that processed your chicken or your turkey. You just type in P- and then the numbers on the packaging. Is there anything, other tips you would give listeners, Irina? Because we're getting a lot of emails about this.
Yeah, I totally understand. I mean, actually, I think 2-3 weeks ago, I was preparing chicken myself in my own kitchen. And I thought, hey, I should check this, check the P number on this chicken I am about to pop in the oven, actually put it on the stove. And to my surprise, it was chicken I had bought before. But to my surprise, I found that the plant actually had, I think, 60% of its samples not only had salmonella, but had the exact salmonella infantis that I had just spent months reporting on.
Oh my.
But you know what I did? I actually cooked that chicken and I ate it for the next, couple days. This is all to say, we want consumers to be informed, but they do not need to be scared, because salmonella is a bacteria that consumers can deal with. And so what's important here is, as Bernice has mentioned, cooking your chicken to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. That is an important number to keep in mind, because that is the temperature at which salmonella bacteria have been shown to die. Another tip that I would make sure to remind consumers of is, when you're using a meat thermometer, not all chicken cooks at the same rate. Not all parts of chicken or meat cook at the same rate. And so if you are using a thermometer, which is great, make sure not only to check certain components, parts of the chicken. So breast meat, I believe, cooks faster than dark meat. This is why I think cooking instructions will always say, make sure to insert the probe at this juncture between the wing and the thigh, because that area cooks slower. Something else that's important is that even if you're handling like a boneless, skinless chicken breast, which is pretty uniform, it's probably going to be different thicknesses. And so you don't want to just probe the thin side of chicken breast. You also want to check the thickest side of it. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. I'm just listening to you thinking it's so unfortunate that people have to go through all of this. And I just wonder, Bernice, in our remaining minute, what will it take to hold these companies accountable for this and to force the government to do its job?
I think on the industry side, that's part of why we made the chicken checker, is the government makes this information available so that consumers can kind of vote with their pocketbook. And this is a way that we are providing information to consumers so they can make informed choices. And then on the government side, I think there's a big argument to be made that, it is a regulator's job, the food safety regulator's job, to make sure that the food is safe before it gets to us as consumers. And if we all feel that there could be more that could be done, there is an opportunity to engage with USDA right now, because they are in this process of rethinking how they deal with salmonella. They're going to be holding a series of public meetings. They're going to be sponsoring some pilot projects. And so, again, this is an opportunity where if you have something to say, you have concerns you want to convey, the USDA has explicitly said that it is listening. So please tell them what you think.
Bernice Jung is an award-winning reporter for ProPublica, and Irina Wong is a data reporter with ProPublica. They and their colleagues worked on an 8-month investigation. America's food safety system failed to stop a salmonella epidemic. It is still making people sick. You can find the piece along with the chicken checker at yourcallradio.org. Bernice and Irina, thank you so much for joining us, and huge thanks to you and your colleagues for this important piece.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering the show. You can find the stories at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there. And you can follow us on Twitter to find out what's coming up at Your Call Radio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
Hi, I'm Ben Trefney, KALW's news director. Glad to have you join us here at a station that's all about the San Francisco Bay Area and its unique and impactful place in the world. Whether it's new music shows or our longtime staples, whether it's news from the BBC, NPR, NHK, or our local newsroom, you can always count on finding what you want to hear and need to know at KALW.
November 30th is Giving Tuesday. This year, KALW is looking to raise $50,000 for much-needed repairs to replace our transmitter and upgrade our call-in system at the station. But you don't have to wait till tomorrow. While you're picking out your gifts for friends and family, give the gift of a better sound quality to all KALW listeners. And please, donate today. Go to KALW.org. And thanks. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, KALW.org worldwide. 1A is next. It's 11 o'clock.